Okay, hi everybody. It looks like the sound is good. Welcome to another Wednesday webinar, but this one is happening on Friday, and Friday, November 21st, 2025. And I also just want to apologize for last Wednesday, and that was not a matter of censorship or any nefarious anything. It was technical incompetence on my part, and I very wish that hadn't happened, but it did. And so hopefully we can play the video again today. And so the point here, there's a couple points. One is I've talked about the issue of nuclear power and nuclear weapons before. And I have a friend, Steve, who's going to introduce himself a little bit. And he did a pretty deep dive into this subject. He wrote a book called A Fool's Wisdom. And he gave a presentation on nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And I thought what would be best would be to play the video in the entirety so everybody is on the same page. And then next Wednesday, if all goes well, and I expect it will, Steve is going to join me on the Wednesday webinar for a live Q&A session. And so if you have a question while you're watching the video, you can put it in the chat and our team will take the questions from there. And those probably will be the first questions that we ask Steve. And then hope maybe if there's time, we'll do live questions next Wednesday. You could probably also write them in if you don't happen to do it in the chat or if you watch the video later. So again, I'm going to play the entire video now so everybody gets to hear the whole thing, the whole argument for the existence of nuclear weapons and nuclear power and what it could be otherwise. And then we'll bring Steve in and talk about the whole thing next Wednesday, and you'll get a chance to ask your questions. And hopefully, you can keep the questions to this topic because I want to put this baby to rest. And hopefully, it's all going to work. I've tried it out about five times, and every time it works. So here we go. And thanks, everybody, for joining me.
Okay, welcome everybody. Today's talk is on the subject of nuclear power. And I've called it Nuclear Power, An Alchemist's Guide. Because my intention for today is to explain nuclear power in alchemical terms without relying on quantum theory or nuclear physics or any explanations involving neutrons, protons, electrons, and this kind of thing. I've been saying for a long time now, since I wrote my book, that I do believe it's possible to understand and explain everything in terms of alchemy without leaning on modern scientific concepts. And this is one of the areas where this idea can really be put to the test. So I'm going to go deep into it. I'm going to show you how this can all be understood and explained without any need of nuclear jargon or any of the quantum theory or any of that stuff. Okay, so let's get cracking. Now, you probably heard this quote before from Dr. J. Robert Oppenheimer. He said, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." And this is the famous quote that he said after they tested the first nuclear bomb. And it's a very dramatic quote, and it sort of rings throughout history and speaks to the seriousness of this discovery, the power of this new bomb that he had discovered. But as we'll see, it's actually quite dramatic and a bit of an over-exaggeration. He didn't actually destroy any worlds. There was a couple of cities that got bombed, but it's not the first time cities have been bombed and destroyed. So he actually got this quote from the Bhagavad Gita, which says, "I am mighty time, the source of destruction that comes forth to annihilate the world." So the original quote is actually about time, which in the Indian tradition is Kala or Kali, time being the cosmic principle of endings and beginnings, and therefore the destroyer of things. In the Western tradition, it's Saturn, Father Time, and Saturn imposes limitations and restrictions and is like the destroyer of things. So he was kind of equating himself with Father Time, the cosmic principle of time itself and the destroyer of worlds. But this may have been an over-exaggeration of what was actually going on there. So the first casualty of war is the truth. And I just have to add this quote in. It's one of those truths that just comes up again and again. And we can't talk about nuclear in any honest way without also talking about war and power. Because when you take the word nuclear and you think, well, what comes next? It's either the word war or the word power. And the first casualty of war is the truth. Very strong quote. If you've been looking into war, if you've been studying it and you've been noticing patterns, you will have noticed this, that like most wars, if not all wars, are predicated on a false flag, a deception. So the whole premise of the war, before even a single shot is fired and a single enemy soldier killed, the truth is killed before any of that even happens. And I just wanted to say this. This is just my own words, but by the spellcraft of propaganda, the lies of war become facts of history. And this whole nuclear narrative is a perfect example of that. So let's talk about war. Now, this is an old image of Mars, the god of war, the personification of the energy of war. So Mars corresponds with wars. And it's interesting as well, if you just look at the word wars and you turn the W upside down, it becomes Mars. Now, what is Mars? It's the martial aspect of the fire element. Okay, so you see he's holding fire there. He's well armored in an iron suit. He's got a red flag, okay, symbol of warfare. And then you can see he's also has a ram there and a scorpion. Now that's because Mars, the planet, rules Aries, the ram, and Scorpio, the scorpion. So that's why those are there. And then there's the symbol of Mars, which is the circle with an arrow pointing up and to the right, which is forward and up at the same time. And this is talking about the fire element. Now, Mar, MAR, means to inflict damage and disfigure. So it's really damaging, but not just damaging, but permanently disfiguring. That's what Mar means. So Mars, you can see how this has this relation to war and conflict. So it's personified as the god of war, and we see this is the Roman god of war, and we see various drawings of Mars in this sort of a style. So it represents the active, masculine, fiery principle, but it's warrior and protector. Okay, so it's not just, it doesn't just go around destroying everything and killing everyone. It's also protective energy as well. Iron is the metal of Mars. So, as we talked about before, every planet has a corresponding metal, which is said to be the earthly manifestation of the energy of that planet. So iron would be the metal of Mars. And iron ore is actually called Martian Earth. So the Earth, the reddish orange Earth that can be made into iron, is called Martian Earth because it is said to contain the fiery energy of Mars, because it can be made into iron, and then iron can be used for bombs and bullets and swords and tanks and defensive structures and all sorts of things. So that the martial energy is contained in potential in the iron ore, and that's why it's called Martian Earth. Now, each of the seven luminaries also correspond with one of the processes in alchemy. There's seven processes, seven luminaries. Well, the process that corresponds with Mars is separation, right? And war separates. Okay, war is separation. And just to add this one in as well, curiously, Mars is also the name for the military auxiliary radio system. And this is a US Army project. It was originally set up to build a system of communication that was auxiliary to the main government system. So a system that the military can use, like originally it was like ham radio networks and stuff, amateurs who would relay military signals in the event that the government became captured. They would have an auxiliary system that they could use to do their communications and stuff. And this actually all ties in with X.com and Twitter and Elon Musk. So, Elon Musk has this whole Mars narrative going on X. Well, this was actually the military auxiliary radio system, you see, because that's what radio does. It's about communication. And that's what tweets are. When you're tweeting on X, you're communicating. And what you have with X, I believe, is actually the military auxiliary radio system. That's what they've created there. And of course, Elon Musk involved in lots of other stuff as well to create communication and surveillance networks and so on. So when Elon's talking about Mars, I think this is what he's actually talking about. And the idea that he's going to take people on a rocket to the planet Mars is just a fantasy, and it's a front, like a counterintelligence. But that's just my theory. So this is from the 16th century, and it's been colored. I found this on Adam MacLean's alchemy website. He has lots of alchemical art on there, and it's a depiction of Mars. And you see down at the bottom, it says Mars there. And then as you go up the top of the archway, you'll see that's Mars, the god of war, and he's up there in a chariot. And the wheels of the chariot have a ram on the front wheel and a scorpion on the back wheel, again, showing the astrological rulerships there. And then down below, we see chaos, basically war and strife, separation. So as I say, war is separation. People become separated from their loved ones. Young men become separated from their families and homes, and they go out to war and have their heads separated from their bodies. The sword, which is symbolic of Martian iron power, is a separation device. Okay, it cuts cleanly, separates things, split things in two. But what we also see here is in war, well, one side of the battle is heavily armored, has uniforms, and has powerful weapons and even masks. And the other side are just civilians in normal clothes, just fighting with basic weapons, right? People fighting with spades. There's like children there. But at the same time, there's like knights fully armored on horses and guys with swords and spears and everything. So it's showing a controlling authority oppressing ordinary people. And warfare is really always like that. It's, they give us the idea that it's like some noble battle between one nation and another. But as far as I can tell, it's always just the elites against the ordinary people. So we see there houses being burnt down in the distance there. And then way in the far distance is a castle. Okay, so Mars is also associated with protection and creating systems of protection. So a castle, a military fort is another example of Martian strength and power. Okay, and then this is a sort of newer one I made with the AI. And I wanted to show that war isn't just bullets and bombs. There are many theaters of war. And here I just wanted to show some of them. I think maybe all of them are captured here. But so the brain there, this represents psychological warfare, okay? Mind control, propaganda. And then below that we have technological warfare, okay? So, computer viruses, cyber attacks, all this kind of thing. And then below that, we have financial warfare, okay? So trade wars, monetary wars, etc. Then along we have biological warfare, so poisons, vaccines, all this kind of thing. Then we have legal warfare or lawfare. And then at the top, spiritual warfare. And then in the middle, where Mars is standing, this could be like the world of the elements. So killing people to grab their land and all this kind of thing. So there's many different theaters of war. And honestly, I don't think war ever stops. I think it just escalates and de-escalates in intensity. And this is what we see with the Mars in the sky. It's a reddish light, and it increases in intensity and gets big and then decreases in intensity. And it never goes away. And I actually think war itself never goes away completely. It just escalates and de-escalates. Now, what about the bomb then? Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, there's a man called Michael Palmer from Germany who has very, very thoroughly discredited the official narrative around nuclear bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And he wrote this book called Hiroshima Revisited. And I recently listened to him on Crow 777 radio. That's worth a listen. And so I thought I would just try to summarize some of his findings here. So what he discovered was that there were no nuclear detonations. It was conventional fuel that was used in the explosions. Specifically, napalm and mustard gas. Okay, so firebombing. Napalm is a form of firebombing. And mustard gas is also called sulfur mustard. We'll come back to sulfur later. It's actually a blistering agent. So the bombs were actually detonated in the air. Okay, so they didn't hit the ground and then explode. They were detonated in the air above the city in order to rain down liquid fire onto the city. All right, so napalm is a liquid. It's like a sticky gel-like liquid. It ignites, explodes, and then it rains down fire below it. So they were detonated in the air, according to eyewitness accounts. The scale of the explosion was totally exaggerated. People within 50 meters of the blasts survived. Okay, so if it was really a nuclear bomb, like, you know, what we're told, destroying a whole city and stuff, then you wouldn't have had people 50 meters away, eyewitnesses and stuff. There was no nuclear fallout. Okay, the city's built right back. Buildings and flagpoles and trees and stuff were still standing. And, yeah, they just got back to life like right after the event. The mushroom cloud. So it's a common mythology is that the mushroom cloud is itself evidence of a nuclear explosion. But in fact, it's not. Any explosive above a certain size will create a mushroom cloud. It doesn't prove nuclear at all. Then there were some strategic deceptions that were involved. So the first one was they had to conceal the use of banned chemical weapons. So napalm and mustard gas are chemical weapons, and they're banned under the Geneva Convention. So to get around the fact that they were using them, they had to come up with a new type of fuel, which was non-chemical combustion and nuclear fuel. It served that purpose. So it was a type of fuel that's not chemical, but it's still combustion. So the chemical weapons law is kind of weird. It's like a sort of rule of warfare where you're allowed to use explosives and blow people up, but you're not allowed to use chemicals to burn them or poison them. Right? So because the bomb contained chemicals, they had to spin it that it was a new type of combustion fuel and not chemical in nature. Then the other strategic deception was to create a psychological warfare advantage. So, to basically put the fear of God in the enemy because they then now think that you've got the biggest bomb ever made. There was political control aspect to it as well. So, the atomic age, as it's called, was a psyop, is a psyop. I mean, it's an ongoing psychological operation that's still active today. It's not actually a real age of humanity, you know, it's an ongoing operation, and It's to establish military dominance. So, what was actually going on there was a large-scale test of chemical weapons on civilian populations. Okay, again, napalm and mustard gas are chemical weapons. Hiroshima and Nagasaki were civilian targets, not military targets. So this was a large-scale test, and it was a test because they didn't test the bomb. So the bomb called Little Boy, the first bomb was called Little Boy, and it was never tested. So this was the test. Media have been complicit. MSM, Hollywood, etc., have perpetuated this false narrative for decades. Again, that's how wartime propaganda becomes unquestionable facts of history. And there was mega censorship at the time as well. So the first Western journalists to get into Japan to report on it was 4 weeks after the explosion, and they had all their work confiscated by the US military. So that was Weller and General MacArthur. I think Weller got in and wrote 25,000 words report on what he saw there, and it was all confiscated by the military. And there was another guy who went in and took a load of photos, and they all got confiscated as well. So, if you want to learn more about Michael Palmer, maybe check out that Crow episode 570, and it goes into it in a bit more depth. Now, full respect to Michael Palmer, he is the guy for debunking the Hiroshima and Nagasaki nuclear narrative. But as he said at the start of this episode, he said, "I am only qualified to talk on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and nothing else." And he was very clear about that. And as the talk went on, I learned that even though he's completely debunked the bomb, he still believes in nuclear physics and he still believes that nuclear bombs are real. So I thought that was an interesting twist. I wasn't aware Michael Palmer still thought that. But he's not a nuclear physicist, okay? So he's actually been debunking wartime propaganda, whereas I'm a nuclear physicist, and so I'm coming at it from the other side and debunking the theory that they're using to justify this. So that was really what inspired me to do this today. I thought I really have to go in deep on this nuclear thing. So after you debunk the bombs, the first thing people ask is, well, what about nuclear power stations? And it's a fair question because nuclear power stations actually exist. Nuclear bombs are just videos. We've just seen videos of explosions and we've been told that those explosions are nuclear, but it's just videos. But what about nuclear power stations? They're real. They operate. We see them around the place. What do they actually do? How do they actually work? Okay, so here's the standard engineering schematic for how a nuclear power station works. So over on the left here, you see in this contained area the nuclear power plant. This is the bit we want to focus on. So there's a core. Now, in the nuclear core, you have water, and in the bottom of the water there, you have the nuclear fuel, okay, the pellets containing the nuclear fuel. And through some process, those pellets are then activated and they begin to heat up and release heat into the water. And this turns to steam, and the steam drives the turbines, and the turbines create the electricity. Okay, and the water is taken in from the river or the lake and sort of goes through the system, comes out as steam, and comes out in these big steam towers or whatever. It's said to work just like a kettle, basically. So if you think of just how a kettle works, that's basically what's going on here. But what's nuclear about it? Well, we're told that the fuel in the core is a special type of exotic fuel called nuclear fuel or uranium. And that uranium has this property where the atoms will split and spit out neutrons and cause other atoms to split, and they will spit out neutrons. And then, if it's done in such a way at exactly the right speed, and the neutrons are exactly the right speed, not too fast, not too slow, then they will create a chain reaction, and this will cause the uranium to release all its energy. And, it's very dangerous, and so on and so forth. And this is what we're taught again and again and again about what's actually going on here. Now, the problem is they're explaining it in terms of atoms. And I just want to understand it in terms of engineering. I want to understand it in terms of real world, what is going on, how can engineers build this kind of thing, and how would an alchemist look at it, an alchemist who doesn't believe in atoms or even know anything about them? It must be possible to understand it in real life terms. Now, again, my goal here is not to debunk nuclear power because nuclear power stations clearly exist. My goal is to explain them in a way that is superior to the explanation we are given by modern science. And I've been trying to put this forward to people that alchemy can always be used to provide a better explanation. And so I'm going to call this principle of explanatory supremacy. There you go. So for every explanation that relies on atomic, nuclear, or quantum theory, there exists a better, more sensible explanation using alchemy. Okay, and that's really the premise of my book. So alchemy provides complete explanations of all phenomena, spiritual and physical. It reconnects science with the senses and the human soul, demystifies technology for a broader understanding, exposes the fallacies of modern physics, chemistry, and medicine, and restores meaning, honesty, and practicality to scientific inquiry. And this is just a little artwork the AI spat out. So I know these AI artworks have errors in them and stuff, but it's quite nice just when it's just to illustrate a point. And I'd been doing a lot of research into this with the AI, and then I asked it, I said, could you just make me an artwork to illustrate what we were just talking about? And then it spat out this. And so you've got an alchemist here, and on the left is all the quantum physics, right? It's all like purple, it's like bubbles in the air and stuff like that, all the equations, right? That's all the nuclear physics, the quantum physics. And then we have this reactor here with uranium written on it, and then these alchemical symbols over. So the alchemist is like sort of standing in the middle, transmuting the quantum nuclear physics explanations into alchemical understanding. You see, it says transmutatio quantum elementalis. So I quite like these just as ways of illustrating what it is we're trying to do here. So I've talked about quantum theory before. There's a presentation, deep dive on debunking quantum theory. I think it's a veil. I call it the quantum veil. I think it actually hides the truth in a cloud of complex theory and equations. So nuclear physics is highly theoretical and complex, like highly. So I got this thesis here that I wrote on nuclear physics, right? And now I'll have people online that will challenge me on the stuff that I put out on YouTube, but I bet you nobody in the world will ever read through all this and verify all the work that I did in here. And I'll tell you why they won't do it, because it takes years. And it'd be very expensive and time-consuming to do, and you know that's the thing. It's so complex and so time-consuming. You need funding, you need years to do this stuff, and no one's just going to do that in their spare time. It's very complex. So nuclear energy is highly secretive as well. It's actually the domain of military intelligence, right? So you think if they've got the secret of world-destroying energy, they're going to teach it to any old Tom, Dick, and Harry who got good grades at school. Of course not, right? So I have a PhD in nuclear physics, but I never understood how nuclear power worked. I know what they told us, but it's not a true understanding. Nuclear theory serves as a veil of illusion to keep the public in the dark. Essentially, mathematical sophistry that deflects attention from technological secrets. Right, we're always told that the military have technologies that they don't want anyone knowing about, right? And that's probably true. And they don't want anyone knowing about it. So they give us things like quantum theory, nuclear theory, and so on to fill our minds with wonder, whilst not actually telling us the technological secrets that is the real knowledge that we want to know. So quantum particle models serve as an unfalsifiable materialist mythology. Okay, so They're unfalsifiable. That means you cannot prove them right and you cannot prove them wrong. They're just because they're in a realm, in a dimension that is beyond your reach and will forever be beyond your reach. And this mythology, and it is a mythology because it has all these characters, right? Like the electron, the proton, the neutron, the quark, the lepton. You know, these are like characters in a mythology existing in a realm and dimension outside of the world. So this leads to a pantheon of particles propped up by a priestly class of impious professors. A lot of P's in there, but that one just rolled off the tongue. This is what we have, right? It's like a pantheon of particles because they're like gods and goddesses. And the only reason anyone believes them is because we have this priestly class of scientists who are constantly telling us about it, but they are actually all impious, right? All these scientists, they have no reverence or respect for God at all. They're impious, they're atheists, and they all promoted the jab. Just got to remember that. Yeah, it's like they actually have no legitimacy anymore since COVID. All right. So, what the hell do they put in these nuclear reactors then? Well, it's something called uranium oxide. At least that's what they call it. And we'll get into what it is. So, it's derived from an ore called pitchblende. Now, that rock there is allegedly a picture of pitchblende. So, you can see it's a rock that has some bright yellow coloring in it. And I would say, we don't want to think of it now as nuclear energy, but as solar fire trapped in matter. Okay, that would be the alchemical understanding, is actually the fire of the sun trapped in material form. So the pitchblende is then purified. All that black and brown stuff in the rock, that'll all get taken out. They'll purify it and get that pure yellow stuff. And it's called yellowcake, or in atomic science, it's known as uranium oxide. Once they purify the yellowcake, they then put it through a process called enrichment. Now, enrichment is essentially distillation, and I'll come to that in a few slides, explain that some more. But it separates and purifies it and potentiates it. Actually, gives it more bang for your buck. And it's stable until it's ignited at the correct temperature. So there's a certain threshold temperature at which it will begin to ignite. And it's suspiciously similar to sulfur. So the picture you see on the left there at the bottom is uranium oxide. And the picture you see on the right at the bottom is sulfur. Now, I don't know if you can tell much difference between them. They look pretty similar to me. This is interesting. But what's in the middle there is allegedly uranium metal. Now you can see that uranium metal looks absolutely nothing like uranium oxide. It actually looks a lot like lead. In fact, it's indistinguishable from lead. And that's allegedly uranium metal. Okay, now important to understand, they don't put uranium metal in the reactors, okay? They're putting this yellow powder in the reactors. Different, okay? Uranium is a metal, and they're not using it. Metals and powders are not the same thing. So, what about yellow cake then? And again, this is just an AI art for illustration. Don't try to follow that schematic and build your own nuke from it. Extracted from pitchblende ore, purified and distilled through the enrichment process, and then it is inserted into zirconium pellets for use in the reactor. Okay, so zirconium is a metal, and they're like little pellets. They fill the pellets with the yellow cake, and so it's like stuffed in there. So the pellets hold the fuel in a pressurized oxygen-free container. All right, so if you imagine the fuel's in there, there's no oxygen in there because it's packed. There's nowhere for it to go. So then they heat it to a critical temperature, which starts the release of the energy from the yellow cake. Now, because there's no oxygen inside the pellets, the fuel doesn't burn, okay? Because oxygen is required to burn. So because they have it in a no oxygen environment, the energy is released slowly as heat instead of exploding as sound and light. Okay, there's nowhere for the sound to go, there's nowhere for the light to go. If you were to ignite it normally, it would just bang, right? But if you heat it in an oxygen-free environment, it will force all the energy to come out as heat because it's the only way the energy can get out through the zirconium is in the form of heat. If sound can't get out of it, light can't get out of it. So all the energy, that solar energy all locked up in that pellet is only able to escape the pellet through the bandwidth of heat. Okay. And it's through that process that the water is heated, that's turned to steam to drive the turbines. Now, in nuclear jargon, they will tell you that it's neutrons, thermal neutrons. That's what they call it. But it's just heat. Okay. It's like if you want to boil water, you need heat. You don't need neutrons. Okay. So the heat is released from the pellets, and that's really what's going on here. And it's kind of a secret. In alchemy, heating in the absence of oxygen is called a secret fire. And I'll talk about that some more in a second. So-called uranium enrichment. I want to call it so-called uranium enrichment now because I don't even think it's right to call this stuff uranium. And I'll get to that in a second. But let's say it's uranium oxide, that's what they call it. How do they enrich it? Well, there's two methods. One is called gaseous diffusion. So they take the yellow cake and they add fluorine, and this turns it to uranium fluoride or uranium hexafluoride, so UF6. And this is a gas. And then they take that gas and then they filter it through microporous membranes. So they'll have like different levels of sieves, like ones with big holes, and then the next one with smaller holes, and then the next one with smaller holes. And they will pressurize the gas like through those membranes and basically purify it. So the holes, they say, correspond to particle size, but it's not particle size, it's wavelength. It's the wavelength of the energy. You see, the smaller wavelength fit through smaller holes. Bigger wavelength, bigger holes. So it's like distillation because they're actually separating the gas into its heavier and lighter components and extracting the lighter component, what they call uranium 235. And then they turn it from a gas back into yellow cake, and then that's what they use as their fuel. Now, there's also centrifugal separation, which is a more modern technique they use. This is where the uranium hexafluoride gas is spun at very high speed, and the heavier components are sent to the outside. So you see it's coming in there in that diagram. The hexafluoride is coming in, and then that whole thing is spinning really fast. So heavier components move to the outside, and the lighter components go up the middle, and then they extract the lighter components. So the reason I say it's like distillation is because this is how distillation works. It's a way of separating the lighter components of a gas or liquid from the heavier components. And that's essentially all they're doing there. And if they're spinning it really fast as well, that's going to impart energy also. Now, I just want to make a note here on metals, ores, and oxides. So atomic science teaches us that metallic atoms exist inside of ores and oxides. That's the way we're taught about it in school. Like the uranium oxide contains uranium atoms surrounded by oxygen atoms, right? So we're being told that the uranium is actually inside the yellow cake. But this is wrong think. It's literally just not how it is, okay? Rust doesn't contain iron. Salt doesn't contain sodium. Yellow cake doesn't contain uranium. Metals are made by transmutation of salts. Okay, it's different. It's not extracted. So metals are defined by their strength, cohesion, conductivity, magnetism, luster, sonority, durability, malleability. Salts have none of these properties at all, but they have the potential to be made into metal. Okay, so a salt can be made into a metal. It can also be made into a crystal. It's a whole sequence of purification. So you start with your salt, you can purify and purify it, and make it into a crystal, and then you can continue the purification to make it into its metallic form, which is like its ultimate state. But there are no metallic atoms to be extracted from the salt. Okay, it's a bit like another example, like flour doesn't contain bread, right? It's like flour can be transmuted into bread, but there's not like atoms of bread hidden inside the flour, right? It's like a process that you have to do, adding water and using fire and heat, and you have to transmute the flour into the bread. The same, with salt, right? We call it sodium chloride, but actually, when you break down the salt, right, you get the chlorine gas and you get soda, which is a fine white powder, and then soda can be transmuted into sodium, but there's no sodium atoms in the salt, right? It's coming back to looking at things in terms of their natural origins rather than looking at things in an atomic reductionist way. Now, let's talk about sulfur. This is really the key to the whole thing here. Okay, so sulfur is not just the fiery yellow chemical that you've heard of. Sulfur is a principle in alchemy. It's the oil, the soul, and the masculine principle in alchemy, the fiery principle. Now, it's fire in matter. This is really what sulfur comes down to. It's the fire of the sun, the active fiery energy in combination with matter. So it's trapped and locked inside matter. And to be fair, they do tell you that in nuclear power and stuff. They will say that to you occasionally, that the energy is locked up inside the matter. It's like, yeah, that's correct. But it's not some exotic nuclear energy. It's the sun. It's the sun's energy, right? That's where all the energy comes from. Now, sulfur is the essence of explosives and corrosives, known as brimstone, burning stone, or devil's gold. It's found in volcanoes, which is where the fire and the earth element are combined. It's present in oil, petroleum, natural gas, gunpowder. It's yellow like the sun, like egg yolk, smells like rotten eggs, like the solar plexus. Looks exactly like yellow cake. And is the active component of napalm and mustard gas. So think about that, right? So the nuclear fuel, uranium oxide, looks exactly like sulfur. The nuclear bomb, which was supposed to contain nuclear fuel, actually just contained napalm and mustard gas, which are both sulfur components. And all explosives, gunpowder, fuels, all contain sulfur. So nuclear fuel is no different in my mind. It's just sulfur in disguise. Uranium dioxide is just sulfur in disguise. So mustard gas is actually called sulfur mustard. Sulfur mustards are viscous liquids at room temperature and have an odor resembling mustard plants, garlic, or horseradish, hence the name. When pure, they are colorless, but when used in impure forms, such as in warfare, they are yellow brown. Mustard gases form blisters on skin and in the lungs, often resulting in prolonged illness and in death. Okay, so mustard gas actually creates the same profile of symptoms that are deemed to be radioactive poisoning. So, what about the chain reaction then? Well, this is what I was talking about, the secret fire. There's no neutron bombardment, okay? They don't have neutron guns. The neutron has never been proven to exist, okay? It's like the whole thing with neutrons is just ridiculous, honestly. You just need to heat the sulfur to a critical temperature to initiate a self-sustaining pyrolytic reaction. Okay, so pyrolytic, which is heating in the absence of oxygen. The anaerobic environment prevents burning or destruction. The zirconium pellet converts all the energy into heat. Okay, so again, no sound, no light, no explosion, just the slow release of heat through the walls of the metallic pellet. Pyrolysis was known to ancient alchemists as the secret fire. It's a way of transforming without destroying essences. Okay, and you can think of it like when you're cooking, for example. You know, it's like the difference between cooking with something that's like covered versus cooking with something that's open, right? If it's open, then all the steam and all the volatile essences are going to get released. Like all the flavors and everything are going to come out in the steam, like when it's being heated. But if it's like contained, if it's like locked in there's nowhere for those essences to go. And if it's protected from the full force of the fire, then it won't burn either. It just causes the food to transform in a positive way. And lots of uses for this. So there's a guy called Christopher Gardner has a channel called Biochar or Biocharisma. He sells this stuff called Biochar, and he uses pyrolysis to make that, and it's very powerful for growing plants and everything. So this is, I believe, the secret behind the nuclear chain reaction. It's actually pyrolysis of the sulfurous fuel that they're using. And the whole thing with radioactivity, well, my view is that it's 100% fire, not material particles, which would be the earth element. Okay, so if the radioactivity is actually spitting out particles, then that means it's releasing the earth element. But if it's all just radiation, then that's the fire element. I believe radioactivity is all fire element, no particles. The Geiger counters don't actually catch particles, even though it sounds like it when they click. They're just detecting radiation. Alpha, beta, and gamma are classifications of fire by penetration depth. So alpha is high frequency vibrations with a short range of penetration. Beta has a mid range of penetration, and then gamma, long range of penetration. Now, here's just a few funny bits. So God bless quantum. So in the lore of the Manhattan Project, it is said that the secret of uranium enrichment was obtained from an anonymous spy codenamed Quantum. And you can look this up. This is official history. And so that means we all owe Quantum a huge debt of gratitude, you see, because the nuclear bomb ended the war and saved us all. So, you know, if it wasn't for Quantum, then there wouldn't have been the bomb, and then there wouldn't have been the end of the war, and we'd all be speaking German, as the saying goes, right? So this little nugget of propaganda subconsciously is telling us that, you know, we owe everything to quantum. But the identity of quantum, it remains a mystery to this day. Still, nobody knows who quantum is, but quantum basically saved the day and won World War II for all of us, according to official history. Now, the first nuclear test on July 16th, 1945, was dubbed Trinity. You can see there's this book here, The Day After Trinity. And Michael Palmer had said that this is actually named after trinitrotuline, which is the real name of TNT, okay, which is what they actually used to do the bomb, okay? TNT is a yellow crystalline water insoluble flammable solid, okay? Just like sulfur. So, yeah, I think they were faking this whole thing. And there may have been people working on it who were legitimately trying to build a bomb and may have legitimately believed in what they were doing. But that doesn't mean they could do it. And they may have needed to fake it, similar to the moon landings, for example, where it was like they made such a big hype about it that they were going to do it. But then when they realized it was impossible, they still had to pretend as if they had actually done it. And I think maybe something like that happened with this nuclear stuff as well. I found this here. So there's actually a whole game universe now called the Manhattan Project universe by this company called Minion Games. And they have this add-on game called Quantum Theory. And I thought it was interesting because the whole purpose of the game is to research quantum theory and build nuclear bombs. And, when I went to study quantum theory, I wasn't thinking about nuclear bombs at all. I literally not even on my mind. I was thinking about fundamental reality. That's what I wanted to understand. But when you look into this, it's all tied in with the nuclear bomb narrative, the nuclear bomb deception, the whole thing. All the famous quantum theorists were all involved. And as I pointed out in my last talk on quantum physics, they all have made up names, okay, which are indicative of working for military intelligence. And I talked a bit about Heisenberg. Actually, in my last presentation on quantum theory, I didn't know what the Heisenberg's name meant. I did a breakdown of all the quantum physicists' names, but I was at a bit of a loss for Heisenberg. But then I actually cracked it after I finished the talk. But so Heisenberg was actually the head of the German atomic weapons program. And he's famous for uncertainty. So the uncertainty principle you will have heard of is what he's most famous for. But people say that was actually what it really was about was his uncertainty over developing the bomb. Okay, he had a crisis of conscience. He thought it was a bad idea to develop this great big bomb or whatever. And really, that's allegedly what this uncertainty was all about. But his name, when you break it down, reduces to H. Eisenberg. Okay, this is significant because H is the abbreviation for Herr, the German form of Mr. Eisen is iron, which, as I pointed out in the beginning, is synonymous with war and Mars. And Berg is a significant accumulation of something. Okay, so if you look up the meaning of Berg, it will usually tell you it means mountain, but it's more general than that, okay? It's like a significant accumulation or mass of something, like an iceberg, significant accumulation of ice. And so we have here Mr. Iron Berg, like a significant accumulation of iron. And we know that iron is martial energy. It's the energy of the god of war, okay? So this is a significant accumulation of martial energy. And could that be a pseudonym for the god of war? If you were building the biggest bomb the world has ever known, this would be an appropriate name to call yourself. So I don't think that's a coincidence. And Heisenberg is not a common name, right? It's a made-up name for this guy. And it was interesting. It was used as the name of Walter White in the Breaking Bad series as well. He used the name Heisenberg as his pseudonym, and he was playing a sort of God of War type role in that movie as well. Okay, well, almost done. So, why all the lies? That's a question we often get. Well, the quantum fiction creates an unfalsifiable mythology presided over by a scientific priesthood. The infinitesimal scale of the work justifies massive funding for research and technology. Okay, this is not research that you can just do at home with regular stuff. You need massive machines and millions and billions to do this stuff. The alleged power of nuclear is so great that it requires total state control and secrecy. Complex nuclear theory obscures the simple thermal, mechanical, and alchemical processes involved. Nuclear radioactivity hysteria scares people away from handling powerful substances. Okay, I think that's probably the main reason for the radioactivity thing is to actually just scare people out of using these materials themselves because you're just like, I don't want to go near that stuff, right? Because it's spitting out like little bullets at me or whatever. It justifies centralized control over energy production and tyrannical safety protocols. And Galen Windsor talked about this. He was the head of nuclear fuels for the US government. And in the beginning, they were just running the reactors with no safety gear whatsoever, handling the fuel, handling the waste, no problems at all. Everyone was perfectly healthy and happy and had no issues. And then all of a sudden, the government came down and said, "You can't touch this stuff. You can't go near this stuff. You can only have 10 minutes of exposure a day. You've got to stay this distance away." And they came with all this tyrannical safety measures. And he said it just completely ruined the whole operation and, made everyone's job a misery. So this deters people from building their own generators and becoming energy independent. Okay, we know they don't want us doing that. It's intimately entangled with secretive military weapons programs. And it's a clever way of circumventing the chemical weapons ban. So, yeah, it's a way of using chemical weapons while pretending that they're not chemical weapons. And of course, you can control the masses by the fear and threat of nuclear annihilation, which they do all the time. So, in conclusion, then, nuclear power is advanced alchemical engineering. Better to call it nuclear than nuclear, because nuclear, the word actually comes from nuc, which means nut. Okay, so it's like a nut or a seed or a kernel, like the nucleus is a nut. So nuclear kind of means of or relating to nuts. But nuclear is more appropriate because this type of energy compared to the old like coal burning stations, this is a new clear type of energy because it doesn't produce smoke, it produces steam. But the problem with that, of course, is you may end up with a lot of rain. So if you had nuclear power stations all over the place, you may get a lot of rain because it's basically just taking water straight out of the river and turning it into steam and shooting it into the sky. Now, nuclear physics is now shown to have no applications. So I think this is really significant. I don't know if other people will, but given what I've shown here, I've now shown, I think, conclusively that nuclear physics has no applications because the only applications of nuclear physics were the bomb and the power station. And if they can both be explained without any nuclear physics whatsoever, then it proves that nuclear physics is a fruitless theoretical science that does nothing. Quantum physics is military-grade mind control. Uranium is a red herring. Okay, it's just a complete red herring. Like they talk about uranium all the time, like they're using it, but they're actually using this stuff called yellow cake, which is virtually indistinguishable from sulfur. All fuel is essentially different forms of sulfur, fire and matter. Alchemy explains all phenomena and technologies, and it's time to reclaim your understanding of energy and matter. Thank you for listening.
Okay, and I would agree. Thank you for listening, everybody. I think that's it. So thanks for listening, and I'll see you on Wednesday.